Hi, I'm Greg.
And I'm Leanne.
Welcome to the Empowered Poly Podcast,
where we give you the tools to help you feel more empowered
in your polyamorous and consensually non-monogamous relationships
by sharing what we've learned as relationship coaches and as individuals.
Empowered Poly is LGBTQ2IA+, alternative lifestyle, and kink friendly.
Thank you for joining us.
And enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 35 of Empowered Poly Podcast. Today, we have an interview with the incredible Evita La Vida Loca Sawyers. Thank you for being here. And I just want to give you a brief introduction. So Evita is a Black, queer, femme, ethical, non-monogamy coach, speaker, educator, and author. She is the creator of Today's Polyamory Reminder, which I love, which has inspired over 50,000 followers. Damn. Oh, she is the author of the newly released A Polyamory Devotional, 365 Daily Reflections for the Consensually Non-Monogamous. And Evita is also the subject of the groundbreaking polyamorous documentary, Poly Love. In her coaching and education, she specializes in navigating the transition from monogamy to non-monogamy, coping with jealousy, and articulating difficult emotions in healthy ways. She is appreciated for her candid shares about her own personal journey with non-monogamy and her frank yet balanced and empathetic approach. Yeah, we are big fans and we're so happy to have you. Thank you for being
here. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm really looking forward to a conversation.
Us too.
Yeah, us too. I love a good juicy conversation. So let's dive right in. Hey, so how do you identify?
So I identify as Black. I am queer. So bi, pansexual, but I just consider myself queer in general. Mm-hmm. My pronouns are she, her, although my grip on gender is a less firm as it used to be. So, but just for the shorthand sake of things, I do identify as she, her. So I am cisgender. I'm able-bodied. I live in Jersey City. I'm a mother. I'm recently divorced. And I am a non-monogamous person. I'm a kinky person. So, above all else, I'm a human being and something even more than that. So
yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I love the saying that we are spiritual beings having a human experience.
Exactly. We are the I remember reading a quote once is we are the universe becoming aware of itself. So and I really
oh, that's great too. That. Mm-hmm. I'm stealing that one. Share with us and with listeners / viewers your non-monogamous, consensually non-monogamous / polyamorous journey.
Oh my goodness. So I like to joke that it started with a song. There's a song by 2 Chainz called Birthday Song. And in the song, it goes, y'all been together 10 years, you deserve a menage, especially if you put that BMW in her garage. And so at the time, my then husband would like joke it with me, you know, because we were getting close to being married about 10 years. And he was like, you know, it's time for menage a trois. And my journey with non-monogamy is also my queer journey as well, because I didn't really have much of a chance to explore my queerness. I knew that I was queer when I was very young, but I went to the military. I was in the Navy, and at that time, you couldn't be out. So there wasn't really a free rein to develop my queer identity. And then I start going to this church, which is where I met my husband. It's a very, very fundamental church. I would say it's a borderline cult. And one of the things that the tenets was, you know, the homosexuality was a sin. So now it's sinful, you know. Yep. And then I get married monogamously to this man. So now I'm in this heterosexual marriage, but I'm still having all of this grappling with my sexuality and not really sure, am I straight? Am I gay? So my son, like I mentioned earlier, when we were talking earlier, got diagnosed with cancer and he was 6. And so life was really crappy. And my husband and I were like, yeah, we need to have some fun. And I was wanting to explore my sexuality. So like most, you know, heterosexual couples or mixed orientation couples with a heterosexual man and a bisexual woman, you know, we start seeking the elusive threesome. So, so that's kind of how we got
looking
into
for the
it.
Third.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, actually, we actually never did that. We were always okay. looking for, we were mostly looking for sexual experiences, you know, in the okay. beginning.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, we went to a strip club, you know, together, and I found that watching him with the dancer just, you know, it didn't make me super jealous. Like, I had my moments, but I also was like, yeah, but I get to be here too with, you know, someone rubbing up on me, so I'm good, you know? So, like, it really wasn't that that difficult to navigate. And then we went to a sex party. And so I always tell people that, you know, when couples have this conversation with each other, oh, you know, I want to get into non-monogamy, it's usually one person kind of, you know, introducing the idea to the other person. But for us, it wasn't like that. It was just one little incident here, then another incident there, then another incident here. And, you know, all of a sudden we kind of found ourselves on this non-monogamous path. And we started with swinging. And that worked very well for me to a point, because I have a very high sex drive. I like a lot of sexual partners, a variety of partners. And so, and I didn't need a lot of like really getting to know a person in order to be able to have sex with them. So swinging, you know, worked very well for me. But it was challenging for my husband, who kind of needs a little bit more of a connection with people before having sex with them, doesn't have as high of a drive, you know, has a, you know, a lot of sexual hangups, mm-hmm. In ways that I don't. And so he was more intrigued by other forms of non-monogamy, like, you know, maybe having an open marriage or, you know, polyamory. And I was initially very caustic to those ideas, because I was like, you know, sex to me was just something that you do, you know, with your body. And so to me, I'm like, you know, it's no other different than any other bodily function at that time. That's, you know, was my, you know, idea about it. So, you know, it didn't feel like quote unquote sharing him, you know, when he had sex with other people, especially because I very much understood the drive to want to have sex with other people, because I had it very heavily. Mm-hmm. But the drive to want to emotionally connect with people and to form emotional bonds with people was something that felt a lot more threatening for me, because I felt like that's what made him like who he was, you know, and I thought those things were mine, you know, his regard, his affection, you know, his time, his love. Mm-hmm. And so we initially decided to kind of open up and, you know, try to pursue like actually dating people. And it was very volatile because I was not ready.
Yeah,
I was not ready. I remember he went on a date once, and I had been on several dates at a time, and, you know, nothing particularly monumental had occurred. But I remember he went on a date once and came back home and talked to me about it. And I just fell apart. Like, I was just, it was too much thought. Okay. Mm-hmm. I was really
too much information.
Yeah. And all he did was say that, because I told him, I said, oh, I guess I had kind of hoped that, you know, you would go on a date, maybe you wouldn't like the person or whatever, because that was the experience that I was having. And he was like, nah, she was cute. And I was just like, what? You know, so sorry. So we tabled it, because we were like, okay, you know, we don't need this much stuff right now. And about 6 months later, we returned to it, because I wanted the opportunity to experience having romantic relationships with women. Up until that point, I had only had sex, you know, and that was fun. But I wanted the opportunity to be able to emotionally connect to women. So we opened up the idea for us to kind of look for people to have more integrated relationships with. Or rather, I'd say more relationships of substance, you know, that wasn't just about recreational sex. And because he and I have such different taste in women, we were like, there is no way that we're going to find the woman that we both like. So you go find you somebody, I go find me somebody, and never the twain shall meet, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of funny. We did not start trying to unicorn hunt. You know, we very much were like, you go find you somebody, I go find me somebody. Mm-hmm. And then we randomly are at a party. We meet this woman, and now we're in this triad.
Oh!
All right.
Yeah.
Randomly.
I love that, because that's the way that's the way that I want to say should, needs, but that's judgment. But that's the way the
it
triad
tends
forming
to work,
organically.
That triad, right, that sort
when
of
form
with three people just kind of vibing each with each other. They usually tend to go better, you know.
As
so
opposed to
I find it's a compulsory, you know, we have to date us both, or trying to make it all three work at the same time. That usually has a lot more obstacles to overcome than when the three people just kind of come together.
For sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Wow, so, what a surprise.
We get in the triad,
And how long ago was that?
That was 2014. Yeah, so 10 years ago. Yeah, is when that relationship started. We were together for about 2 years. None of us knew what we were doing because it was all of our first time at the rodeo. And so, you know, you can take from that what you will. And that relationship is actually the subject of a documentary. And funny thing, right before she came to film the documentary, maybe about 2 days before, she was checking in with us and we had broken up.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so the documentary was for her film school thesis. She, you know, called us 2 days earlier and was like, hey, you know, I'm just calling to, you know, verify things. And we're like, yeah, we broke up. And she's like, and so, but we filmed it anyways. And it actually ended up making for, I think, what is a much better film. So, and then once that relationship ended, you know, we were just open and in from that point and, you know, had a variety of, you know, non-monogamous and polyamorous configurations. And then in 2020, my husband and I separated and we divorced in 2023. So, so now I'm just kind of, you know, single and being non-monogamous, which is a definitely much different place to navigate through it than when you have a quote unquote anchor partner. And so, yeah, that's my journey through.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for being so detailed. And so like, I just, I fucking love that. Thank you so much.
Oh, we swear on this podcast. We didn't mention that.
Good. Cause I cuss like a sailor.
So awesome.
Yeah. I was a sailor, right?
Yes.
Yeah, there we go.
So you mentioned your separation and divorce. You've been really vulnerable on social media about all of that. What's that like? Have you had any issues with that? I mean, how does that feel to you? Was it something that you really wanted to do from the outset, or you just kind of decided, hey, now I need to be vulnerable because I'm going through something and people are wondering, or how did that come about?
I mean, I've always been, it's funny to me. It always makes me chuckle, you know, when people praise my vulnerability, even though I understand why, you know, and why it connects people to my work so much.
Yes.
But I always tell people that for me, by the time it makes it to social media, it's not super vulnerable for me. You know? Yeah, it's actually not. I've usually processed, you know, for the most part through the emotions, or at least enough to like understand like what's going on.
Yeah.
And so the sharing of it with others, you know, isn't really vulnerable for me. I think I find it more vulnerable when I have to come to a loved one or, you know, someone that I actually care about and kind of sit directly across from this person and say, hey, you know, I'm hurting. Because, you know, I guess there's a hope or an expectation or whatever, you know, that, you know, something is going to get done about it. Whereas when I'm going to social media, it's not me like reaching out to this group of people saying, hey, I need something from you. Mm-hmm. It's usually me giving them an offering, you know, and saying, hey, you know, in you hearing about my story or me sharing this with you, maybe you'll find, you know, yourself in here and there'll be something for you to glean. Or also sometimes it's just wanting to sort of respond to how isolating those experiences can sometimes be and going, hey, like, you know, sometimes it's just me going, can I get a witness? You know, this shit is hard, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. And then too, I had spent so much time talking about my relationships. I was like, okay, you know, this is a part of what's going on for me too. And, you know, this is part of the story and there's things to glean, you know, from this movement through a non-monogamy. I also think that it's really, really important for people to not want to paint a picture that non-monogamy means that, you know, it's okay because your relationship will survive it. Well, sometimes they will, you know, and hopefully they do, you know, that's the goal, I would think, but, you know, sometimes they don't. And that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with non-monogamy or, you know, that it needs to stop or see, it never works, you know. You know, relationships end in non-monogamy and people continue on with their lives, their non-monogamous lives, even after they're over. And so I think it is really important for people to not want to paint that picture. And there's such a like a sort of lure to paint that picture because people are already afraid of that coming into non-monogamy. I'm going to lose my marriage. I'm going to lose my, you know, partner. And so I think that there's such like a draw to want to, you know, paint this picture that, oh, your relationship can survive this. And I'm like, maybe it can't, but that's okay.
Yeah. There's that fallacy that monogamy is somehow more, because it's more structured, or at least people think it is anyway, more structured, that it's somehow safer, more secure, in that you won't lose your partner. When the reality is that it still happens one way or the other. It doesn't really matter.
I mean,
what dynamic
50, over 50% of the marriage, what is that, 50%? Divorce rate is like 60%. So like, yeah. And you know, whenever, you know, marriage is in, or even relationships in, it's rare for people to blame monogamy. Usually people that are blaming monogamy are probably people that are not monogamous anyways.
Exactly.
But it's rare for people to blame monogamy. They just go, that's the way, that's what happens in relationships. And so, but some strange reason when it comes to polyamory, the first thing that they attack is, well, see, that's because that non-monogamy stuff doesn't work. And I'm like, relationships end.
Yeah. And then Greg and I have both been divorced three times before marrying each other. And we've both been unethically non-monogamous. And so in a way, for me anyway, I can't speak for you, but I definitely felt like, hey, this monogamy thing is restricting, you know, like I'm very restricted here and it's not necessarily a structure that works for me. So yeah, interesting. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, that is a really good point. Before I ask the next question, I want to acknowledge my privilege on all levels. And the way I acknowledge my privilege is saying that I am the single most privileged human being on the planet for three reasons. One, because I'm white. Two, because I'm male. And three, because I had the good fortune to be born in North America. So I'll never know the experiences of what it's like to be Black, what it's like to be female. I do know the experiences of being queer and bi because I do identify as that. But the other pieces that really fascinate me are the pieces that I don't understand or that I don't have a lived experience with. And that is, I'm curious to know your experience as a queer Black woman in the polyamorous community specifically. How's that been for you?
I mean, I would say that we all exist to some extent on both sides of the privileged, unprivileged coin, you know? So it would do us well to be able to like navigate both of those experiences, you know? Barring if you're like a Black, trans, disabled, femme, you know, you know, that you're like really like, you know, at the end, like the bottom of like all these or the other side of like all these marginalizations. And so it has its ups and it has its downs. You know, I am Black, I am queer, I am a woman, but I'm also able-bodied. I also was born in America. I've also had access to education and resources that allow me to you know, present as very intelligent, you know, and you know, garner respect you know, when I'm interacting with people. And so it definitely does cause you to have to grapple with a lot of the internalized messages that you receive, you know, with whatever identities that you carry. And so there's that piece of it, and like how do things like colorism or, you know, ageism, like all of those things impact like how I feel about myself and how secure I feel in my relationships as my partners are interacting with other people, how secure I feel in my own desirability as I'm, you know, trying to date and relate to people. And then, you know, I lived in San Diego when I first got into non-monogamy, and there was not a very large Black non-monogamous community. So that was like the first time that I opened myself up to, you know, dating people of other ethnicities and races. And then that was, you know, an experience of like, you know, having intimate relationships with these people that we didn't have the same socio-cultural, you know, kind of shared experience.
Yeah.
And so that was new. And then, you know, kind of dealing with, I don't feel like I dealt with a ton of like fetishization. I do think that it did occur at some point, you know, but I was usually pretty good about kind of sniffing it out, you know. And so, yeah, so I don't feel like I dealt a ton with that personally, but I can definitely see how, you know, it occurs. I will say that there is this sort of, I feel like for when I first got into the community, most of the public face of non-monogamy was very white. So like, I didn't see myself reflected in the communities that were talking about this until I actually stumbled upon Black polyamorous community. And then once I found the Black polyamorous community, that was great. But we were all kind of, you know, spread apart in these pockets. So online groups were, you know, the saving grace for that. And then I find that because of it being seen as deviant and people of color and Black people being like censured more highly, mm-hmm. And more severely for living alternative or any kind of deviant sort of life, it can be very secretive of the Black community.
Yeah.
About talking about, you know, being non-monogamous or talking about being kinky. So even, you know, my openness was sometimes a challenge moving through the community because, you know, most Black polyamorous or a lot of Black polyamorous are very quiet. You know, they don't want any kind of fallout from, you know, it's like I said, being judged very heavily for living this kind of deviant, quote unquote, life. So, yeah. And then just kind of dealing with the same things that you deal with inside yourself or the same things that other people are dealing with you. So, you know, misogyny noir and all of those things. And so it's definitely been a way for me to connect more fully with my identities, and in some ways can sometimes put me at odds, you know, because I'm, you know, even in a queer community, people may be queer, but they're likely not non-monogamous, you know. In a Black community, people may be Black, but they're likely not queer, you know.
Yeah.
In a non-monogamous community, people may be non-monogamous, but they're, you know, they may not be Black. And so I think I always feel like in the groups that I find myself in, even if I share one thing with them, there usually is still something that makes me an outlier in another way. So.
Yeah, that wow. Finding that intersectionality between all of those things can be challenging, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. And so you mentioned something. We had the word noir in it.
Misogyny noir.
Misogyny noir. Can I ask you what that is? I've never heard that term before.
Yeah, so it's a very specific brand of misogyny that is directed at Black women. So, you know, large in part, having the identity of woman in this patriarchal society is a marginalization. And then in those marginalizations, you have echelons of marginalization. White, you know, cishet women being at the top, and then, you know, we just kind of go down. And, you know, probably at the bottom would be like a Black trans woman, and just right above that, you know, would be a Black cis woman. Mm-hmm. And so misogyny noir is a very specific brand of misogyny that targets Black women more severely in the echelons of the marginalization of being women than, you know, any other ethnicity, because it's right, it's that intersection of patriarchy and racism, you know, right at that, mm-hmm. that cross section.
Yep.
Is where misogyny noir lives.
Mm. And so if misogyny noir would be misogyny is perpetuated by Black men on Black women?
Anyone.
No, really anyone. No? Yeah, no, oh. It's not just Black men on Black women. It's anyone. Misogyny noir is a global. Yeah. It's global. Yeah, and it spans all identities. It's a prevailing, like I said, it's right at that cross section of patriarchy and racism. Yeah, so it's okay. Misogyny noir.
Thank you for bringing that up. Wow.
Thanks. That was a bit of a tangent, but I just want to investigate that a little bit because I got curious.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
That's,
thanks.
That's a great investigation. I wrote it down too. I was like, I got to know what that is. I think I do, but I don't want to make assumptions. Well, I'm going to tell you this book that you've written is beautiful. I love it.
Thank you.
It has been like just a sweet, easy read. I love its structure. You've got 365 days. Each day has a topic and then an explanation and then questions to reflect on. The reflection questions are very insightful, very helpful. Highly recommend the book. It is hopefully going to be the subject of a book club that we're doing. So we have a Facebook group and we have these open Monday discussions about polyamory and consensual non-monogamy, and then we do book clubs when we find a juicy book that we love. This is on our list, so I would love to do that. And I have some favorite pieces that you wrote about, and we're just gonna talk about them, if that's okay. I think the idea here is to get the more organic personal take on it, and anything that you would want to add. We can even maybe talk about the questions. I think the questions are awesome.
Yeah, the questions are fantastic.
Yeah.
The whole fucking thing is fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're very excited for you. Okay, so day 50. It takes courage and vulnerability for our partners to share hard truths with us. Telling a loved one something that you know will cause them pain isn't easy. Keep that in mind. And you mentioned that you were thinking about this when your marriage was ending and how difficult it must have been for him to finally tell you that he no longer wanted to be with you. And the questions that you have here are, do you honor the courage it takes for your partners to share a vulnerable or hard truth with you? And how do you show that? First of all, I love the follow-up question of how do you show that? Because that's really important to say, okay, you might honor it internally, mentally, intellectually, but then how will they know? So was this a steep learning curve for you, this one?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I love it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's interesting because she asked the question, was it a steep? My question would be, is it a steep learning curve? Is it still?
Not as much, because through practicing non-monogamy, I've developed the ability to maybe stay a lot more grounded and centered when someone is sharing something with me. Because usually what happens is, you know, someone shares something with you and it rocks you, you know? Mm-hmm. You're not really able to like absorb that shock, you know, and I call it kind of the experience of becoming punch drunk, you know? So it's like someone like, you know, impacted you with this difficult truth and now you're sort of disoriented because you're kind of, you know, woozy. So I've developed the skills to be a lot more centered in that space. So that way, you know, even if I get hit with something that is very jarring, I'm still kind of planted firmly. But, you know, I do have moments, you know, because I'm still human. And, you know, we've not heard everything that we're going to hear that's going to shock us, you know, in life. We just haven't. So I think it's more about just tool development when that does occur. But in the beginning, it was very much a steep learning curve, too, for several reasons. One of my, like, you know, models that I tell people about myself is I'll get over it. I just got to be dramatic about it first, you know? So I'm definitely one of those types of people, you know? It's like, I get over it. Just give me my moment to be dramatic about it, you know? And then I'll be fine. So, and so that's kind of a function of how I am as a person. And on my end, I know that there's nothing wrong. This is just me going through, you know, the motions of processing through the experience or processing through the difficulty, but someone on the other side of that, like that can be very challenging for them because, you know, they don't know if me saying, I don't know if I can take this. Oh my God. What? You know, if this is not me saying that I'm not going to be able to continue to be with you or I'm going to leave or, you know, just whatever, you know, I'm really upset with you. Or, so, you know, I recognize now that while that is true about who I am as a person, and it's important that I let people know that that is a function of how I exist, but I also do need to mitigate that so it's not showing up in an unbalanced way. But that was something I had to learn how to do and develop the tools to be able to do that. And then also, I think there was a challenge for me in that because of how dramatic I was about things, my then partner at the time would often conceal things from me or what I call watering down the tea, you know, so he would not give me the full strength of whatever it is that he was trying to communicate. And I would, you know, kind of know that that was kind of going on, but not really be sure. And so then when he would finally get to the place of being like, well, this is what it is, it seemed that much more intense, you know, whereas if he would have kind of ripped the Band-Aid off in a way a little bit sooner, it would have helped me, you know, to kind of get used to him being more forthright, you know, about the things that he wanted and didn't want.
Sure.
So so it wasn't entirely, I don't think, you know, we both were on that stage, you know, I'll say that, you know, we both were on that stage doing that dance with each other. But yeah, it was a steep learning curve. And there's a really good quote by Ram Dass that I just read recently that was like an aha moment for me of like what happened in this process of like learning how to do that is he says, will you help me awaken by sharing your truth with me? You know, it may be uncomfortable for me to hear, but that's my work. And that's really what it was, is learning how to awaken to, you know, the truth in our relationships, which, you know, non-monogamy has a very specific brand of, you know, learning doing that. So yeah, it was
for sure
a learning curve.
Yeah, that's great. Wow. That's amazing. Thank you very much for sharing that.
I relate to that so hard.
Me too.
I do. You know, the reactivity that comes up, right? That initial shock, the punch junk that you were talking about. Yeah. Learning the tools to manage that is such a game changer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's coach to coach. That's one of the biggest things that I deal with when I'm working with clients is it's not what's happening, it's how you're reacting to it.
Yeah.
And it's the story, the narrative playing out in your head about what's actually happening, right? And I think that being able to manage the emotions and stay regulated in those moments has a significant impact on the outcome of those situations.
Yeah, and we're often not really aware of what's playing because we're not really encouraged to kind of pay attention to the scripts that are running, you know? Mm-hmm. So oftentimes something happens, a switch flips, and now you've got this narrative that's running, and you're almost kind of sort of doing things in response to that narrative without even like really being aware of what story is happening for me right now. You just get caught up in the, I call it like music. The music just comes on and all of a sudden you start doing the dance to that song. Mm. And so like a flip, you know, like, yeah, so, you know, switch flips, the waltz comes on and you just start waltzing. And then mm-hmm. you're like, but wait a minute, you know, is the waltz appropriate for this situation? Do I want to be waltzing right now? Like, it's like, I think, you know, I've moved into an arena where, you know, now when this happens, I want to do the jitterbug, you know? So like, but you have to be aware, you have to be aware that that music is on and that you're responding to that narrative and then going, you know, what CD do I need to put in to replace this one so that I can do the dance that I want to do? Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Maybe that's why I love records so much, is because it's an intentional step in listening to music and being in a space specifically rather than just having whatever pop on, you know, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so that's really a good point. One of the things I really loved about the book was you don't tell people how to do things. This isn't do it this way in order to be successful. In my experience in this work, there are people in the world, like dating coaches, who say you must do these 10 steps in order to be successful at dating. The reality is that with this book, the one thing I loved about it was it's an invitation. It's an invitation to get curious about what's going on with you and why you're here. So all 365 pages or days are invitations to take a look at how things are playing out for you and whether or not they're serving you in the ways that can foster deeper and more meaningful connections. And to that end, actually, there's a question here. It's day 212. It says, monogamy is a zero-sum game and thus creates a scarcity mindset around romantic love. It helps to shift the narrative from scarcity to abundance as we seek to connect with others. And of course, the question is, do you feel scarcity around love? If so, what do you think that scarcity stems from? So that was one of the ones that really stuck with me. I've been non-monogamous most of my adult life, probably all of my adult life. I've been consensually non-monogamous for the last 17 years. The differentiation between those two is the word consensual, but also the knowledge and the information and being able to apply who I am and find my community. And so when I think about monogamy being a zero-sum game, mm-hmm. it feels incredibly restrictive to me. Like I literally, like viscerally tighten up when I think about it, mm-hmm. right? So I'm curious to know, what was your experience in writing this particular page or this particular day?
Part of my own personal work in healing my relationship to relationships, because we have to heal our relationship to relationships.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just how we act in relationships, right?
Yeah.
Right. Is moving away from, so I have an anxious preoccupied attachment style. And part of what my struggle is in relationships is scarcity, believing that, you know, this is just something that is just not out in the world in abundance for me, is romantic love, sexual love, desire, you know, ardor, all of those things, companionship. And so that causes me to be very clingy, you know, when I do find it. And I will say that, I, you know, clingy gets such a bad rap, you know, and I don't super like the negative connotation of that. We tend to think of clingy in bad terms, but when I say clingy, is for me, it's just this energy of grip on my relationships, and not in like a, I'm holding this because I'm holding this with strength and support, but more like I'm, you know, white knuckling this because I'm like, don't take it out of my hand, you know?
Yeah, yeah, right.
And so I'm like, yeah. You know, it's just like, you know, grabbing onto it because of this belief that this is a scarce resource for me in the world. And so when I do find it, I have to kind of do the Gollum, you know, my fresh ass. You know, from Lord of the Rings.
I get it.
Yep. Right. And so some of that is life experience. Some of that is marginalization, you know, being Black, being queer, et cetera. Yeah. These are all things that, you know, part of the narrative of being, you know, marginalized in any way is, you know, being told that, you know, you're not good enough for the good things, you know? And so, yeah, so, you know, there's a little bit of that in there also. But yeah, so for me, in order for me to move away from that, you know, my precious, you know, kind of clinging to my relationship so that I could be at peace, you know, when my partners did things that on the surface or, you know, to me because of, you know, being socialized, monogamous, whatever, we're like, oh, this is threatening. This is threatening that resource. This is something that's going to take this away or cause you to not have this anymore, to cause you to lose your grasp on it. And, you know, part of that work was going, I need to stop seeing this as a scarce resource. Mm-hmm. Because not only does that impact the relationships I'm in, it even impacts my potential relationships. When I'm looking at this as a scarce resource, I may be much more inclined to get involved in relationships that I probably shouldn't be involved in because, you know, I'd take the red flags and, you know, turn them into a flamenco gown, you know, I'm like dancing around in, you know, because I'm like, this is a scarce resource. And so I have to take, you know, any opportunity that this presents itself. So working through trying to bring my anxious attachment style into balance. I'm not one of those people that believe we need to figure out how to get rid of it. I think all the attachment styles are just, you know, bits of information about us. They developed in certain ways. They have their pluses. They have their minuses. Mm-hmm. And it's about knowing which one yours is and bringing it into balance, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, part of my work for bringing that into balance was going, how do I, you know, what do I do that? And some of it was having to change this belief about scarcity as it relates to relationship. And then in non-monogamy, even more so, because non-monogamy actually narrows, you know, the pool of people that you can draw from. If you're someone who only chooses to, you know, deal with other people that are non-monogamous, it drastically reduces, you know, the people, so that can even hone in, you know, that belief that, you know, it's scarce, because now I've put myself, you know, in an arena where, you know, the options are a lot smaller. I think there's also something to be said for doing scarcity work around this belief that you can only receive certain things in the context of romance and sexual relationships. So removing scarcity around, you know, this is the scarce resource, and it only comes from this one source in my life. But being open to having intimacy of all kinds and all varieties from people, and kind of seeing that, you know, the world is an abundant source and my relationship is an abundant source of those things, instead of just looking to this one relationship area that I have in my life to get that resource from, thus making it scarce.
Wow, that's awesome. You are such a fantastic person to talk with. I'm mesmerized.
I know.
When you're talking.
I'm just like, wow.
I'm like, did she just fucking use the word ardor in a sentence?
Yes, she did.
The right way. So I'm like, oh my God, I love this human being so much.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful. I digress. But anyway, I just wanted to share that with you. You're gonna have goosebumps, and it's just not pretty over here.
No, it's pretty. It's pretty.
Is it pretty? All right.
Yeah. Okay. I'm enjoying it. Yeah.
All right, good. Good. As long as you're enjoying it.
You got a fanboy. Right.
Maybe a little.
Okay, I'm gonna do the next one. It's hard to choose. I'm gonna say that. It's hard to choose. There's so much good stuff in here. I want to do it all. You know what I mean? Like, I'll just talk to you about everything. But
can we just do this for the next 365
days? what are you doing?
On the phone in the morning?
Yeah. So I had to choose between, I think I'm gonna just do one more because of time, but I love this one. If your partner is reasonably asking for reassurance and you have the ability to offer it to them, doing so is an easy and loving way you can give to your partner. You may not understand why they need it, but recognize that they are struggling and your reassurance can put their mind and heart at ease. Oh, Love that. Do you struggle to give your partners reassurance when they ask for it? How does it make you feel when your requests for reassurance are met with resistance?
So before you answer this, I just want to say something about this. This actually just came up for us in our relationship the other day. Mm-hmm. Not related to non-monogamy specifically, but related to interaction between the two of us. Leanne had presented something to me, and it was a need. It was something that she wanted. It was something that she was struggling with about our relationship check-in meeting and the fact that I wasn't taking it. The narrative she was telling herself was is that I wasn't taking it as seriously as she was, or as she would like mm-hmm. me to. And so, of course, I was telling myself a completely different narrative because I didn't even realize that that was happening. But when she presented it to me, I immediately got defensive. Mm-hmm. Instead of offering that nurturing, instead of opening that space of empathy and understanding and care. And so it's interesting to me that this is one of the questions, because not only is it very present for me, but it's also something that I still struggle with. You know, being somebody, I have borderline personality disorder, as well as I have a disorganized attachment. They kind of go hand in hand, I think. To really hear your take on this is really exciting for me. So thanks for listening.
I think that, well, thanks for sharing that. People tell me all the time that my work is very eerie for them. So
yes.
I'll have people say all the time, they'll be like, will you hear that?
You're Google, aren't you? You're fucking listening to everything, aren't you? You're Google.
Right, yeah. I'm like, through the cell phones, and so I'm hearing everybody's conversation in polyamory, and then I'm like, you know, I'm going to make this about their specific problem because they need to hear this. So yes, I love when people tell me about that. I've had people, you know, message me and tell me that my work started arguments with their partner. Some people read at your own risk. And so I love when people actually connect it to personal circumstances that they have, because I feel that, you know, that's what I want. You know, I didn't want people to find me, you know, mm-hmm. I wanted people to find themselves, you know, in the book. Yeah. That was my, that's like, don't look for me, look for you, look for yourself, look for how you feel about things. That's the point. So, because you'll be much more self-assured when you know what your answers are. Right. So, but in this one specifically, I think what happens when someone asks for reassurance, or, you know, first of all, that's a very vulnerable ask. It's saying, it's going to the person and saying, I'm feeling little and small and unlovable and unworthy. And I'm believing that you believe those things. And it might not make sense to you why, and you might not believe these things, but, you know, that might not be what you believe. But, you know, I'm struggling with that because I'm struggling to believe this about myself right now, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you coming to me and telling me this would maybe help me to believe this about myself, or help me to believe, you know, to return to the belief that, you know, I am worthy of love and I'm worthy of your love, you know? Mm-hmm. And I find that what I think happens on the other end of that is, I think there are people for whom giving that reassurance is very vulnerable, because the flip side of that is telling this person, hey, I love you and you matter to me. And that can feel very vulnerable for people to know, you know, someone to know, hey, you matter to me, because that means that if I know I matter to you, then I know that my absence or my leaving would cause you pain, you know? So I think there's a little bit of it being just as vulnerable to give reassurance for people. Mm. I think also that sometimes people take those requests for reassurance and they turn that into, this person is saying that I'm not doing a good job of showing them that I care about them.
Yeah, that's it.
Because doing a good job, you know, of, you know, showing this person that I cared about them, then they would not need reassurance because they would feel sure of my love. I thought I was doing a good job by communicating my love. This person isn't feeling it. And then requesting this of me is them telling me that I'm not doing a good job. And so then that's where the defensiveness comes in. You know, or like this defensiveness is like, why would this one thing that has no bearing on how I feel about you be indicative of now my feelings have changed? So I think people also sometimes feel a little hurt by, oh my goodness, you know, why would you assume that because I did this, that this impacted, you know, how I feel about you? Do you think I'm that shallow, or do you think I'm that easily moved or swayed, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think people make people's requests for reassurance about themselves instead of looking at, you know, not saying this is not about me or myself at all. You know, this is about this other person, you know, struggling to kind of feel my love, or struggling to kind of feel, you know, Like, I care about them. And then there are some instances where, you know, someone may be with someone that no matter how much reassurance you give this person, they're just not going to feel it because they're not doing their personal work of getting themselves to the place where they can receive the reassurance. And they're sort of outsourcing their responsibility to do some of their own work of, you know, shoring themselves up onto this other person and going, you have to do this for me all the time in perpetuity, because I'm literally working on not giving myself any of this. And that can be very taxing and very draining after a while. But I think a lot of it really, like I said, has to do with, you know, kind of people sort of, you know, feeling affronted, you know, it's like, oh, you know, are you saying that I'm not doing a good job? You know, because why are you not feeling like I love and care about you? I'm showing it to you. Can't you feel it?
that's so actually definitely... That's definitely what I felt. That's what I heard was that I wasn't enough. I fucked up. I did the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Right. And so that was definitely where the defensiveness was coming from. And of course, I didn't realize it in the moment. I thought I was justified. I thought I was, you know, getting curious and I thought I was doing all of, and then as soon as everything just sort of calmed down and we were able to take a step away from the situation, I realized, that's what happened, you know?
My nature, when I'm feeling fully resourced, is to be loving, to be kind, to be sweet, to be generous, to be happy. And so when I find that that's not happening, there's some kind of need that I'm not aware of or some kind of boundary that's being crossed that I haven't instituted yet, you know? So like in the case of like what you were talking about with, you know, them saying, hey, I need reassurance, you know, you're not knowing that that made you defensive. And it's like, oh, I have a need to feel validated in how I'm showing up to this person, and that's not happening right now. And I'm feeling, you know, judged and accused and all of these things. And you might, you know, and you might have needed to say, hey, like, you know, I can offer you that reassurance, but also, you know, I'm going to need some reassurance that, you know, this is just your thing. You know, you just need this reassurance. And this is not you saying I need this reassurance because you're doing a bad job. Which are two different things, you know?
Right. Yeah, totally.
I think that's where we got to, right? That's what happened. We debriefed and came around to that,
Yeah, and I think it's also, too, one of the things that happened for me when I was able to disconnect from it was I was realizing that there were things that were clouding my ability to be able to hold that space. I'm dealing with my father's deteriorating health and stuff, and that's really impacting me because, you know, I'm feeling powerless. I'm feeling very, very helpless. And so in that moment, I transferred a lot of that powerlessness and that helplessness onto her.
Right. It's like, this is another area where I can't do anything, or I'm not doing something, or there's this out of my hands, and I'm already feeling that. And, you know, it would be nice if, like, we had these, like, separate emotional reserve tanks, you know, but it's just, we just have, like, one emotional reserve tank and just all of the different areas of our life are sort of pulling from it, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And so when we're going through something challenging in another area of our life, it's not like we can compartmentalize that in that area and then go back to these other areas, you know, fully resourced. It's like, no, this is pulling on that bank, and it's affecting how, you know, sensitive how I am receive. In these other areas of my life. Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. It affected how I receive the information. Because like you said, when I'm feeling perfectly resourced and balanced, I think I'm, for the most part, I'm a very curious, empathetic, and compassionate partner.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
There are times when I'm an asshole.
Right. And we all have those times. I honestly am a little attracted to assholery personally. The Lord hasn't been through me yet. I like people that are a little comfortable with going, you know, I'm not always going to be tea and crumpets all the time. And I'm going to work on that so that it's not out of control. But, you know, I like humans. So
it's
part of being human.
Me too.
That's awesome.
Me too. So should we move on to the next?
Accountability is an important part with that.
For sure. Absolutely. Accountability, responsibility, and compassion.
Humility, you know, all
humility,
the
abilities. Yeah.
All the abilities, right. Curiosity, right. Just put a word and end it with I-T-Y and you're good. So let's move on to the next question here, because I'm really fascinated about, I'm fascinated about all this, but I want to hear about some of your experience with this. So my understanding is that kink is something you've recently discovered about yourself based upon your IG, your Instagram. What intrigued you enough to try that, and to specifically impact play and all of the things that go
Honestly, being in environments where I can engage in kink with other Black people. So that really helped me to feel a lot more safe to want to explore it. You know, when I first got introduced to the kink community, it was when I lived in San Diego, and it was a very, very, very white community. And I never, you know, had anything terrible happen to me. You know, I'd go to kink parties and things of that nature, and, you know, it was fine. But, you know, there's a certain depth of safety you have to have in the body, you know, in order to engage in kink and sort of push those edges that may seem a little bit more extreme. And, you know, it wasn't until I found myself in, you know, mostly POC, mostly Black kink environments that I was like, oh, like I actually can do this. I can actually explore this because I felt a lot safer in my body. In those environments. And so, yeah. And I also think there was some misconception about kink as well, because I would see people that were like really, really, really into it. And I'm like, ah, that's not me, you know? So it sometimes made me feel like a poser, you know? And so that's why I like, you know, kind of, you know, stayed away from the community, because I was like, y'all are really serious about this in a way that like I'm not. And I can sometimes, you know, come off as what I feel is irreverent. And that's a space where like reverence is a big deal. You know? So there was a little bit of that too. And then also there was just a little bit of like not really seeing myself as kinky, because I'm like, like this to me isn't deviant or strange. This is just shit I like to do. So like, why do I have to like, you know, why do I have to give it a special name? Like, you know what I mean? It just all falls in the category of shit I like to do. So, so that was a little challenging for me. So it was a little like stubbornness there. Of like, no, I'm not going to say this just because this is what you guys said I am. So there was a joke amongst my friends that I was vanilla with sprinkles, because I would always like, I'm vanilla. And they'd be like, you are not a vanilla girl. And the joke was that I was vanilla with sprinkles. And now like I've officially been like, okay, guys, you know, I'm kinky. And everybody's like, it took you long enough. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
That's nice. Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, congratulations. As somebody who identified in the kink community as a dom for 10 years, it served me well in the time that I was there and in the time that I was in that space and in the time that I identified as that. And I thought, you know, it was a beautiful experience. So I wish you nothing but the best.
There's so much learning that happens in the kink space, and so much self-discovery. It's just a different way to discover yourself that I'm really enjoying. So I'm also learning just how many pathways there are to pleasure and turn on. You know, when you open your mind and sort of expand your ideas of how you can experience those things. And so more pleasure is great. I'm enjoying my exploration. Yes.
That's lovely.
Good for you. And before we close this particular question, I just want to point out that one of the popular misconceptions about the term kink as it relates to BDSM is that they are interchangeable, and they are in fact not, because kink is an umbrella term under which BDSM is a type of kink. But there are other kinds of kinks that don't involve impact play, don't involve power exchange dynamics or DS or any of that stuff. As an example, exhibitionism is a kink, right? So it's really just anything that fires you up sexually that would be considered outside the norm or the traditional vanilla term. So I just wanted to point that out to people listening or watching.
Mm-hmm. And as somebody who has worked with a lot of people in the kink community, I also want to point out that you finding that space, that safe space for yourself, is so key. I've heard that from queer people. I've heard that from trans people. I've heard that from women. You know, just because you see it presented to you in a certain fashion, you know, like the DS dynamic, for example, being typically cis men with bi women, right? Doesn't have to look like that. It's often not. And so we have to kind of question what we've been seeing and look for the people that align with us. And I'm really glad that you found that, because that's the game changer.
It was an absolute game changer for me. It was a total game changer. I was like, oh wow, we do this, you know? So and we do this in our own unique ways. You know, mm-hmm. Black kink is very, very unique. And it's a very affirming experience to be a part of.
Yay. More pleasure. Yay. Okay. So I'm just going to be mindful of the time. We've got about 5 minutes left. And we have two questions. So hot take, just a hot take. What's the top advice that you would give to somebody starting out in their journey into polyamory and non-monogamy?
Ooh, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. That's what jumped out at me. It is uncomfortable, even when you are predisposed to this. Like, I think there are some people that just naturally come in and it's like a homecoming. It makes sense to them, you know? Or you think you have a handle on how you're going to react or how it's going to impact, or you find yourself in some situation at some juncture that is going to make you deeply uncomfortable, and you need to be okay with that, because that's where the gold is. You know, it really is. And don't become so comfortable with discomfort that you put up with stuff that you shouldn't. You know, I think that there is room to mention that, because even though I do say get comfortable with being uncomfortable, but you know, there's discomfort, and then there's like, okay, this is not cool. You know, this is wrong. This is wrong for you. And, you know, it's hard because that is often very subjective. You know, there are definitely things that are like, yeah, this is probably wrong for pretty much the entire swath of the human populace, you know, but a lot of things don't super fall in that category, you know. Mm-hmm. So don't get so comfortable with discomfort that you're actually putting up with harm or abuse or relationships that aren't good for you. But get comfortable with some discomfort, because that's where you grow and that's where you learn.
Mm-hmm. Love yes. that. 100%. Yeah, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. So really quick, how did you get started as a personal coach and speaker?
It started with me. I was in a lot of poly groups and stuff online, and I would just talk about my movement through my emotions, about awarenesses that I had. And at that time, you know, on the internet, it was challenging because everybody was in these poly groups, you know, and fronting about how much conversion they feel and how great everything is all the time. And it was hard for me because I was just like, that is not my experience. I'm not having that experience at all. And nobody's talking about, you know, how hard this is. And I'm like struggling. So I, you know, started just talking about my experience, just like I said, trying to get somebody to say amen, you know, and people kind of started soliciting me. For advice, for help, to talk about it. You know, I realized that I have a very unique ability, and the articulation of emotions is a place where I really, really shine. I can really give language to people's emotional experience. And so people would reach out to me, you know, just for advice. And my friends would be like, look, I'll pay you. Like, you know, can I just talk to you for an hour, you know, about the situation that I have come up. And then when the pandemic hit, I was like, well, let me challenge myself and see if I can do like a polyamory reminder a day for 365 days. And that's kind of where, you know, it took off.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. And by the way, just so you know, I had a visceral goosebump reaction to you talking about emotional articulation, because I too really resonate with that. I think that's where I shine as well, in terms of being able to help people name their emotions, because in the naming of their emotions, there's so much power, so much understanding that comes with that process, right?
Yeah, it's learning just being to able communicate to for your emotions and not from them. I feel like that has been like the key component for me. It's like not letting speaking for my emotions and not letting them speak for me, you know?
Yes.
And that means giving them a language. That means like being able to confer with them, get their message, and communicate that either to yourself or to the world around you, so that they feel like they're being advocated for, because they're really just our little like baby part selves.
That's
and they're
right.
like, you know, speak up and say this, speak up and say that. But if we don't have a language, we're not versed in sort of translating, you know, what it is that they're saying, so that we're advocating for them and essentially advocating for ourselves, is where we get all these like, you know, maladaptive strategies. Because I would say your emotions, they're going to get their airtime. Okay.
Yeah, they are. They are.
One way or
another.
Whether
you like, it or not, damn it.
Yeah.
Right.
So just a really another hot take. What is something that's a misconception about you or about polyamory or non-monogamy, whatever you'd like to address here?
I think that people assume, and I think, you know, people assume this about me just because of who I am, which I also find really funny, because I'm like, I talk about this all the time, you know, but I think that people just assume that, you know, people that engage in non-monogamy just somehow have some kind of magic something that just makes it okay for them to deal with, you know, these things. I'm like, no, this stuff is hard for us. It's challenging. We're going past programming, you know, same like everybody else. You know, some people are naturally, like I said, predisposed to doing this for whatever reason, you know, blessings to them, you know, but a lot of us, and even those people, still have to unpack things, you know, because, you know, we don't escape the societies and the cultures that we, you know, grew up in. But I think, you know, there's this kind of misconception that, you know, somehow our partners doing things with other people or having to show up to our partners doing things, you know, with other people, it's like less acute, you know, for us, or less sharp, you know, than it would be for, you know, someone that was monogamous. I think it's kind of, there's just a lot of just funky stuff. I kind of have to pay attention to a lot of it because I'm just like, okay, that's what you think about it, whatever, you know? So I tend to be like, okay, whatever. I grow weary with sometimes like monogamy simply because I don't feel like these good faith attempts to understand are actually really attempts to understand. Yeah. And so I just have a very limited patience with like moving through, like, you know, responding or even just showing up to all. I'm like, if you want to think that about us, think it. Like, you know, we got a lot of shit we think about y'all, you know? So, so that's kind of the way I feel about it. Right. Yeah. Like, I feel like sometimes, you know, and I like this happens for me on a micro level, but also on a macro level. You know, people sort of believe that, like I said, somehow, you know, I'm less prone to getting activated or impacted or feeling tender about some of the things that happen as my partners relate to other people. And I'm like, no, like I'm a human being, you know, I just have different responses to it than maybe another person would, or, you know, I check that against what my goals are, you know, what my goals are, what my principles are, what my ethics are, like, you know, what these choices that I've made to be in relationships in the ways that, you know, have value to me. Mm-hmm. And then I just make different choices, but it doesn't mean that like I've somehow figured out how to be like Zen Buddha above, you know, feeling threatened, you know, that my partner is going out with someone who's younger than me or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Like, oh yeah.
I'm like, no, you know, I still deal with that challenge, but, you know, I've just chosen different responses than the typical ones, you know, that we hear, oh, you know, you got to make a big deal about it or tell them to, you know, stop messing with the person or all of those things. I'm like, yeah, you know, those aren't the answers for me now because they're not in line with, you know, what my relationship values and modes of operation are. So I have to come up with different answers, but, you know, it's not coming from this place of like me somehow having transcended, you know, the challenges and, you know, the fears and the feeling threatened and, you know, all of that stuff. I'm like, no, that still very much happens. You know, yeah. I just, you know, deal with it differently. And on a macro level, you know, it's the same thing.
Yeah, wow. I get that. And I feel like there's that other thing that happens too, where polyamorous or ethically non-monogamous people will say we're better than, right? We're more evolved than the monogamous, right? It's just different. It's just different. Their relationship values are in alignment with what they're doing. Our relationship values are in alignment with what we're doing. So that's the key. And I think that was a really important point that you brought up.
Yeah, the monogamy, the societal structure and how we function, and that needs to be brought to critical analysis. But if you just boil it down to just monogamy itself, even if we broke all that stuff down, there are still human beings that would want to be monogamous.
Absolutely.
And that's okay. And that's not any indication of any, you know, lesser evolved sense of, you know, love or whatever. It's just that's the value that matters to them. And that's all right. So, and that has its drawbacks and its benefits. Saying like, you know, non-monogamy has its drawbacks and its benefits. So there are ways in which monogamy is challenging. There are ways in which polyamory is challenging. And you know, we're all choosing the challenges, like I said, that have value to us.
Nice. Sure. I love that.
Sure. So thank you. Thank you for everything. Thank you for all of this. This has been so fucking enlightening and amazing and just all of the stuff. I want to end this by asking, how can people find you? Give you an opportunity to plug anything that you might want to plug and any last sort of final parting wisdoms.
Yes. So you can find me on Instagram at LaVita Loca 34 on Instagram. I'm also on Facebook at LaVita Loca Sawyers. I will be presenting at Southwest Love Fest this year. That is in April. I believe it's the 12th to the 14th. And that is being held in Tucson, Arizona. So I hope to see some of you there. I'm looking forward to it. It's my first time presenting at Southwest Love Fest. I have my book, Polyamory Devotional, 365 Daily Reflections for the Consensually Non-Monogamous. It's available at all major retailers. And I'm really, really grateful to be for others what I needed when I was navigating through this becoming. So that's what non-monogamy is a becoming, you know, of sorts. And so as I was, you know, moving through this becoming, it brings me joy to give voice to people's emotions, give voice to people's fears, you know, give voice to people's needs and wants and their tender hearts, their tender baby selves. You know, my encouragement on this is, to me, the greatest benefit of this endeavor has been the self-discovery. So I've learned so much more about myself that I feel has helped me to become a much better human. And I'm not saying that polyamory is the only way to do that, because it is absolutely not. But that was a vehicle for that in my life. And, you know, all really areas of our life can be vehicles of that, you know, if that is our intention. But I'm grateful for the ways it has developed me to be the kind of loved one that I want to be to the people around me, and also the kind of loved one that I want to be to myself. So I'm grateful for this opportunity to have this conversation with y'all. It was amazing.
It was amazing.
Really enjoyed talking to you both. Thank you. And so thank you so much.
We'll have you back anytime. Anytime.
I have a new best friend.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Hey, Bestie.
Yeah.
Thank you
so anyway, much. Yeah, we would love to have you back anytime. So it's just been fantastic. I don't know. How do we wrap this up?
Well, we do our usual thing.
That's right. That's right.
So we have a little tag.
We have a little thing that we do at the end here. So yeah. So
are you ready?
No, I want to say thank you one more time. Okay. I feel like I'm drawn to an expression of gratitude. So I really want to thank you again for showing up and for being so present with this, and for all of your words of wisdom and just your energy and your amazingness, and for sharing your story and your journey with the world. So I personally am inspired by it. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was great.
Yeah, and I'm just going to echo that. Seeing you online, first of all, and having that access to you there, and now your book, and now getting to meet you, is just such a joy. So thank you for sharing your tender heart with us.
You do it. That's right. You do it. We always fuck this up. Always. Don't edit this part out either. Let people see this.
Okay, ready?
Yeah.
And remember,
choose love.
And keep it kind.
Yeah, I love that.
We'd love to hear your comments, questions, or topic suggestions. And don't forget to subscribe.
And you're invited to join our Facebook group, Empowered Poly Relationship Support and Advice.
You can reach out to us on our websites at gregmillion.com.
And at leannemillion.com.
Or follow us on Instagram at thegregmillion.
And at leannemillion.